Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
And I know the answer to the question that everyone keeps asking. I know why you did this. You did this simply because you were not in a cage.
But was she dead on the day I arrived?
She was dead when you killed her.
I agree with the family. I hope you die in prison as well.
It disgusts me that you are allowed to exist.
If you watched Gone Girls on Netflix recently about the Long Island serial killer alleged to be Rex Huberman, then you probably heard with some interest the mention of a case that made you kind of think, I wonder what that case was all about. Well, don't worry, I did the digging and I have the information for you. Now, if you didn't watch it, don't worry, it's not at all related to today's case except by some of the players from like the district attorney's office. But there is lots of layers to this one, and so we are going to go all in and dive very deep into this most brutal of cases. This is the murder of Johnny P.S. Johnny P.S. was born to his mom and dad, John and Barbara, on August 1, 1965, in Smithtown, which is in Suffolk County, New York. Popular and active in sports, pretty much your all-American boy. He was adored by his parents as their only child. And on the evening of April 20, 1979, Johnny was 13 and he was working on fixing up his bike with his dad in the garage. And he asked his dad if he could take his bike on a ride, like a test drive, over to the Dogwood Elementary School to sort of test it out, expecting that his friend Eddie Pembroke would be there that he could talk to. So John, his dad, said that it was fine, but he needed him to be back in like about 15 minutes because it was getting dark. And the school was only a 5-minute journey by bike, so that was fine by him. And at 8:25, he was seen by Eddie's sister, also out riding her bike. And he had also been seen by another neighbor pedaling out of his driveway around 8:15-ish. Eddie's sister said that when she saw him, he was pedaling really fast and was heading in the direction towards the school. But by 9:30, he had not yet returned. So his father, now annoyed, went to the school grounds to get him. He actually drove there, but he wasn't there and neither was his bike. He called his name into the darkness and was met with silence. He then kind of canvassed the area asking people if they had seen him, which he did that for about 20 minutes. He stopped by Eddie's house as well, and Eddie said that he hadn't seen him at all that evening. And so that's when he learned from Eddie's sister that she had seen him. So he returned home and was now pretty concerned. He called family and friends to help with the search, as well as contacting the police to report him missing. And the police arrived at the house at about 11 p.m. And around 4 a.m., they actually called Eddie back and asked him if he would show them this treehouse that they had been sort of building together. But he wasn't there either. So Johnny's dad returned home to wait for some word, any word. The next morning around 10:30, two kids playing in the schoolyard found Johnny's bike and also his wallet and his baseball cap in like this wooded area surrounding the schoolyard. They left the bike where it was. One of the boys did take the baseball cap, not realizing, of course, the significance of it, and turned the wallet over to their baseball coach, who then called John to tell him that he had Johnny's wallet on him. So John and some other family members rushed back to the playground to retrieve the wallet. John's niece, so one of Johnny's cousins, then saw his bike. It was kind of buried under some leaves at the bottom of like a small little hill. like a culvert kind of thing. John or his niece, there is some conflicting reports over who, heaved the bike up and then leaned it against a tree and then continued searching for where Johnny could maybe have gone now without his bike. At 1:30, John and Barbara's neighbor, Joseph Sabina, called from some bushes that he had found Johnny. He had, like, his bike been buried with some leaves and some heavy logs as well and some branches thrown over him. There was a log covering, like, the right side of his head and another one covering one of his legs. So Joseph picked up the logs and moved them and then called for John. Now enter Detective Thomas Gill, who is from Homicide. He showed up at the scene at 2:30 p.m. and the first thing that he noticed aside from Johnny's body was some drag marks in the dirt from where the bike was now leaning against the tree. He told Joseph to not mention to anyone about the logs that were on his body, not because he was trying to cover that up and didn't want anyone to know about it, but because he wanted that detail about the logs to be like hold back evidence. Johnny's battered and broken body was transported to the medical examiner's office, where the autopsy found that Johnny had died from traumatic asphyxia and compression of the chest and neck. So what that means in layman terms is that he was basically stomped on his neck and chest. There were also 6 rocks shoved down his throat to cut off his oxygen supply. 5 of them were above the tongue and 1 was below the tongue, which of course blocked his air passages. There was a number of bruises on his body and the impression of a sneaker tread on his cheek. Now, according to the autopsy report, they were determined to be consistent with somebody standing on his throat and placing rocks in his mouth. And Johnny obviously had died a brutal and rage-fueled death. Now, forensics were not able to find any hair or fibers, and the shoe tread on Johnny's cheek was similar to a puma, Fava or Speck style. They also found about 6 other shoe prints around the area. Now, all of the shoe prints that are mentioned a lot later in this story, but they never find a match to any of them except for one of them matched to Eddie Pembroke, who was John and Barbara's and Johnny's friend and the neighbor who helped them initially in the search. Shoe prints on a public school playground are probably tough to use as evidence anyways because, well, for one, there wasn't much of a police search in that area. It was like family and friends and neighbors. So there were a bunch of people in the area searching and could have walked like right by Johnny's body initially because it was concealed by branches and stuff. And it's a public space, like used by everyone in the community. So you can't date and like timestamp shoe prints on sand or soil. And as for the shoe print that was on his face, which was definitely evidence of a brutal killing and highly unnecessary and makes me sick to think about it, I don't doubt that it was like a puma-styled shoe, but I think it would be hard to scientifically prove that, being that the face isn't really a flat surface for leaving like an identifiable print or an exact match for a shoe size. We can just say that it was consistent with a puma diamond shoe. So basically, they didn't find any forensic evidence. So solving this case is going to be based on circumstantial evidence, eyewitnesses, and or confession if they can get one. However, having said that, they didn't bother to take the shoe prints of anyone, like anyone that was in the search efforts, to compare and rule them out. So there is that. The other thing that made this a difficult case to solve is that the medical examiner couldn't really narrow down the time of death, just putting it between 3:45 p.m. when we know he was still alive, according to all eyewitnesses, and as late as 3:45 a.m. on the 21st, which just isn't very helpful when it comes to even circumstantial evidence. Like it's hard to develop a timeline. Anyways, I bring this up because, well, you'll see. So they do what they can do, and that's look for possible witnesses and to try to track Johnny's movements. So John Bailey, and like, sorry, there are a lot of Johns, Michaels, and last names that sound like first names today, but we're going to be okay. So he was 14 years old, and he lived across from the school. And there was also a Mrs. Kalia who was babysitting his siblings at their house that night. Mrs. Kalia is described in court documents as elderly. So in 1979, that could have referred to a woman anywhere from 50 years old to 100 years old. Both John and Mrs. Kalia remember John's dog barking intermittently between 8:15 and 8:35 that night. So they are thinking, based on the proximity of their house to the school and where Johnny's body was found, that the barking indicated some kind of altercation at that particular time. And this was likely when Johnny was killed. John Pies's dad arrived at the school at 9:30 p.m. and there was no one around at that time. So it's likely that that's the time that he was killed, but it's not exactly provable. So Detective Gill interviewed a few kids, like teens from around the area. Three of them were 17-year-olds John Sparling, Michael O'Neill, and Raymond St. Denis. Now, they had been seen in that area that night, but when they were asked, they all denied being there. But when brought in for official statements, John Sparling said that him and Michael and Raymond had gone to the beer store at 7 p.m. and bought a case of beer. When they came out of the store, they saw Thomas Ryan, who's another local teen, his yellow car, pull in with his friends, Robert Brezik, and brothers Michael, who was 16, and Peter Quaterio, who's 17. Now, things are going to get really hard to follow, so just stay with me here. So John Sparling, the witness, and his friends, Michael and Raymond, talk a bit with the four boys in the yellow car, sell them a six-pack of beer, and then the three of them left the parking lot around 8 p.m. So that's John Sparling, Michael, and Raymond all left. And they walked the path to the school. John Sparling says that between 8:15 and 8:20, he saw the yellow car again at the school. So this time it was Robert Brezik, who was sitting on a small, like, motorcycle, but it's sometimes described as a mini bike. And he's, like, holding the driver's side of the car, like, so he's balancing on the bike and then talking to whoever was in the car, which John Sparling did not actually see who was in the car at that time, but it's assumed that it was Michael and Peter and Thomas in the driver's seat. So John Sparling says that he called to them, but the car actually pulled out of the school parking lot and then went down Dogwood Drive and turned right onto Rice Lane. John Sparling says that he never saw Johnny Pies that night at all. Now, what is kind of important is that the police never asked for John Sparling or his friend's shoes for any comparisons for prints of the scene. Now, why was that? I have no idea. Because they considered the footprints to have evidentiary value, even though I don't necessarily see that. But they did. So why did they not ask for his shoes? I mean, they obviously asked for Eddie Pembroke's shoes because he was in the search area and he actually matched one of the prints, but they ruled him out right away as a suspect. But three kids in the area admitting to drinking beer underage, they don't even ask them for their shoes.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
So Detective Gill, who was leading this investigation, 5 days later, he meets up with Robert, Thomas, Michael, and Peter. And this is the four boys from the car. And when he talks to them, they're all together. So he asks them as a group where they were on the night of the 20th. And Robert Brezik, he speaks for all of them and says that they were at the high school watching a baseball game. Now, this is a lie because the school principal confirmed that there was actually no game that night. And they were likely giving that story because they had been drinking and they were all underage. However, by this time, the murder of Johnny P.S. was news all around town. So they could have been lying to cover up involvement in his murder. But again, it's circumstantial evidence. It's not proof of anything. Like, kids lie all the time. I'm actually not surprised that they lied to him and that it was Robert that was doing the talking. Robert, Peter, and Michael, and Thomas are all under the age of 18, varying in ages from like 14 to 17, from what I gather. John Sparling and Raymond St. Denis are all but kind of forgotten now as possible suspects and even witnesses at this point, but not Michael O'Neill. And on the morning of April 28th, they put him under surveillance, hoping that he's going to meet up with Thomas, Robert, and or Michael and Peter, who are the four boys again from the yellow car. But they never saw Michael O'Neill that day, and instead they saw the yellow car. It's a Capri. And at this point, they actually think that the four boys from the car are actually covering up for Michael O'Neill as the lone murderer of Johnny. So Detective Gill brings Thomas Ryan and Peter Quattario in for questioning, and they put them into separate rooms. Then they brought in Robert Bresnik a couple of hours later, again in a separate room. Now, I can't tell you what's going on in the rooms that Robert and Thomas are in, but I can tell you what's going on with Peter. So Peter was 15 at the time. He says that, yes, he saw Michael O'Neill, John Sparling, and Raymond St. Denis that night. And yes, he purchased beer from John Sparling. And then he admits that they did steal a mini bike and that he had been in attendance when Thomas and Robert had stolen the bike. To which Detective Palumbo, not to be confused with Columbo, hammered him that if he was covering up for O'Neill, John Sparling, and Raymond to tell them everything that he knew, to which Peter said that those guys had nothing to do with Johnny's death. Actually, it was Johnny Brezik and Thomas Ryan that had done the killing. So Palumbo says, well, then tell us what did happen. And like, I don't have the word for word confession. It was later ruled as inadmissible, if I didn't already tell you that part. And we'll sort of get to that. But I have the summary of it from an appeal document. So while they were stealing the bike, they saw Johnny Pius on his bike. And in fact, Michael, his brother, not Michael O'Neill, briefly spoke to him. Well, after Johnny rode past on his bike, there was sort of a discussion between Robert and Thomas that they were worried that Johnny had seen them with this mini bike and might rat them out. So they made the decision to go and find him and talk to him. So all of them, so that is Peter, his brother Michael, Robert Brezik, and Thomas Ryan. There is no mention of Starling, O'Neill, or St. Denis at this point. Drove to the school to look for him, since that is where he appeared to be heading. And they spotted him towards the back of the school. So in Peter's initial telling, only Robert and Thomas got out of the car to go after Johnny, and they returned looking frightened, out of breath, and excited, and told Peter and Michael what they had done to him, including the detail about the rocks in the mouth and the logs put on his body. Now, they wanted him to draw a diagram of where everything occurred, but Palumbo wanted to kind of see it for himself. So they all went out there together, including Peter, leaving Thomas and Robert back at the station in their own interrogation rooms. So this was a little bit earlier in the evening. So Michael and his mom had not shown up at the station yet. They're going to show up later. And when he was able to sort of show them where the murder had taken place, although still said that it was him and his brother had stayed in the car, but after some kind of back and forth, admitted that they had actually, him and his brother, had actually followed Robert and Thomas and witnessed the beating, during which Johnny, who was only 13 and completely innocent in all of this, started to scream, as you would. And that is why and when they had shoved the rocks into his mouth and jammed them into his throat. When they realized that he was dead, they of course freaked out and dragged him into the woods, throwing some leaves and twigs on him, as well as the logs, and then covered up his bike a bit and hightailed it out of there. Now, apparently at this point, Peter says that he's worried about being a rat to the other boys, and Palumbo tells him, well, don't worry about it, because Thomas Ryan was already confessing to everything as well, and that he was pinning everything on him, so he should kind of bury him first. And basically told him, like, you're young enough, nothing's going to happen to you, like, we're going to take care of you. Now, both of those statements are an outright lie, which is part of the reason that the confession never made it into court. Not that the officers can't lie necessarily, but they can't make promises that nothing's going to happen to you and like tell a kid that, oh, this guy's going to pin it all on you, so you should probably pin it on him, kind of thing. Well, saying that to him did do something, because Peter then said that, you know, I might as well tell you, Mike and me helped. Mike and me chased PS2. We all shoved rocks in his mouth, hid the body. It happened so quick, and that Robert had told P.S. not to say anything about the mini bike. P.S. said, of course, he wouldn't say anything. And the next thing he knew, Rob had pushed P.S. and they all started fighting with him. He was screaming some expletives and Rob said, shove rocks in his mouth to shut him up. So then Palumbo does something else that made anything further that Peter might have said inadmissible. He turned on a tape recorder in his parole card car without telling Peter that he was recording it, what he said. So of course the reading of his Miranda warnings wasn't on that tape, and he asked him again, like, in detail what he had done, and he told him. Now apparently these confessions went into the trial for Peter, but they were later ruled out on appeal because they violated his constitutional rights. But we'll get to that. And then get this. So Peter's mom actually had to file a missing persons report on Peter in order to find out that he was back at the station at this time, which was around 7 p.m. So Palumbo says that he tried to reach her, but that the line was busy. Probably because she was frantically looking for him. So anyways, that is when her and Michael came down to the station, and then they were put into the room with Peter, and then Peter was then asked to leave. So Peter was told to tell his mom what he had admitted to, and much to her shock and horror, I would imagine. So after spilling all this to his mother, they then asked Michael to come back in. And I'm just going to read this because this is directly from some legal discovery stuff. Just so you know, what happens is Michael is taken out of the room. Peter then is told, tell your mother what you just told us. And he proceeds to tell his mother about the killing of John P.S. Michael is then brought back in, and Palumbo then asks Michael to tell what happened the night of the 20th. And he, meaning Michael, says things to the extent of, I don't know what my brother is talking about. I have nothing to do with it. Peter then says to him, Michael, I just told him everything. Tell the truth. I already told them that we killed Johnny, or words to that effect. Michael's response to that is, I don't know what my brother is talking about. I drank beer with those guys. I rode around in the car with them. We stole a mini bike. I don't know what my brother is talking about past that, though. Again, words to that effect. And again, Peter says, Michael, please, I told them everything. I told them that we killed John. At that time, Michael says to Palumbo, hey, I don't know what he's talking about. All you cops got me for is stealing a mini bike. I had nothing to do with killing P.S. Police then go to all four boys' houses and collect all of their shoes, as well as the mini bike that they admitted to stealing. They also took their sneakers from their school gym lockers, But nothing came back as a positive ID to any of the prints that were at the scene, including the one that was on Johnny's cheek. So other than this confession from Peter Quaterio, which again was later deemed to be inadmissible in court, they only had statements that they were able to get from some other kids in town. Not John Sparling's crew, but some other kids. So Thomas, Robert, and Michael all maintained that they didn't know what Peter was talking about, that they didn't do anything. And Peter does later recant his confession. However, it was this recorded confession that sort of cemented a rather big hatred and rage in John and Barbara against all of these boys. John had to actually be restrained in court a couple of times over the rage that he felt. And he actually attended the trials every single day, and the tension in the courtroom was palpable. All four of them were charged with Johnny's murder, but not right away because they were trying to gather more evidence on them. So I have to tell you a little bit about some of the civilian witnesses that had conversations with the boys and what they testified to when all of this apparently had happened. Because after the confession is thrown out and without any physical evidence tying any of them to the scene, these witness testimonies are all that they have. So even John Sparling, Michael O'Neill, and Raymond St. Denis didn't really put any of the boys at the scene in having witnessed anything other than the possession of this mini bike. In early May, Robert Brezik is with a kid named Brian Dunn and Michael O'Neill. And remember, Michael O'Neill was originally the sole suspect, and also Peter Quaterio was there as well. And they're sitting at the bleachers at the Smithtown High School and talking about Johnny's murder. And Robert turns to Peter and says, "I wouldn't have stepped on him if you didn't put rocks in his mouth." Then in July or August, there was another conversation. This time in attendance was Robert, John McCourt, Danny Colcutta, Michael Burke, David O'Brien, Michael Quaterio, and James Burke. Now, James Burke was the one that was mentioned in the Gone Girls documentary, but it this point in time, he is only a 14-year-old boy. He later becomes the chief of police in Suffolk, but we'll get to the kind of the gossip about that a little bit later. But for now, he's just a neighborhood boy. They all testify that they were drinking beer behind the feed store near the St. James Railroad Station. Now, they all give a slightly different version of the conversation, but the gist of it is all the same. Most of the boys here range in age from 14 to 16, and they were talking this time about Johnny's funeral that had taken place. Michael Quaterio was asked by Danny, who had killed Johnny, and Michael had said, "Ask Brezik," like Robert. And so Danny asked him, "How could you kill someone for just stealing a mini bike?" And Michael said, "If you were drunk and stoned and you didn't want to get caught, you would do the same thing." Then sometime in September, the same or a similar group of boys were at the St. James Elementary School. And the gist of this conversation was that someone had asked Michael if he was still under investigation into Johnny's murder. So at that time, Michael had told them that the detective had shown him photos of Johnny, with his face, with his nose smashed and covered in some leaves, and had said, "The pigs fucked it up and too much time had passed," or, "No, it's too late. The cops fucked it up. The pigs fucked it up. They'll never catch us." Something like that. The specifics vary on depending who is remembering the conversation, but the gist of it was that. So these trials all started in 1981, but in February of 1980, while Robert Brezik was in jail awaiting his trial, there was another conversation that was testified to, and this one was between him and a fellow inmate, Brett Locke. Now, Brett was, he was actually the inmate representative for the jail tier where they both were. And this was just the day after Brezik had arrived at the jail. So he was actually being harassed by some other inmates that kept calling him Pebbles. And Brett told them to knock it off and asked him, you know, like why they were calling him that. And he said, I didn't mean to kill him. We didn't mean to kill him. And then he said that him and his friend, Tommy Ryan, and the two Quatario brothers were riding around in Tommy's car drinking and smoking, and that he knew where to rob a mini bike. And they went to the house where they stole this mini bike from the garage, or like by the garage. And then they met at the school. They were sort of checking out the mini bike, and this little kid, Johnny P.S., was riding a bicycle and observed the group with this mini bike. And one of the brothers said that they better go talk to this kid because he had problems with him in the school and he'd rat him out about this mini bike. And so Tommy Ryan said, no, don't worry about it. Everything will be all right. There's enough of us here to where he's not going to want to say anything about it. And so then they put the mini bike back in the car and then dropped it off at one of their houses. And the brothers, Michael and Peter, kept insisting that they better go speak with this kid because he's going to rat them out. Like, he had had some trouble with this kid in school and he's definitely going to rat them out. So that's when they went back to the school, somewhere in the area of the school. They found him. And they sort of called to him. So he was trying to ride his bike away. So they caught up to him and Robert punched him in the head. And then he went down on the ground and they all just kind of started punching and kicking him. He started to scream quite loudly, as again you would. And he said to put rocks in his throat that it would shut him up. And he stuck pebbles and rocks in his throat. And a little while later, they realized that he was, of course, dead. And Tommy Ryan said, drag the body into the woods because he didn't want to put it into the car and get noticed with a body. He said, we will drag it into the woods. So they dragged it into the woods and covered it over with some leaves and sticks and stuff like that. And that was all that Brett Locke had listened to. Okay, so that is bad. But now listen to this. Now this is from somewhere. It's a legal document. Robert Bresnik's appeal document. That makes sense. Locke did not inform anyone regarding the defendant's statement at the time it was made. The first time Locke spoke to law enforcement officials about the defendant's statement was in August of 1981, when Locke was arrested on burglary charges. When he was arrested, Locke asked that the homicide squad be contacted because he had some information about a case. Detective Miller came to the jail and spoke to Locke. Locke offered to give Miller certain information about the PS case if the detective arranged to have Locke released on his own recognizance. Miller had Locke released. However, Locke fled the area before he spoke to Miller. Locke eventually relayed the contents of the defendant's statements to the district attorney's office when he was arrested again on burglary and drunk driving charges. As a result of his cooperation, Locke was permitted to plead to a reduced charge. Okay, so at the trials, the defense all came down to the confession was coerced or illegal, and he had also recanted his confession. None of the other boys ever admitted to killing or participating in the killing. There was no physical evidence, and the kids' testimony, well, they were all just kids. And Deborah Dietrich, who was the ex-girlfriend of one of Bresnik's brother, Philip, testified that she had been babysitting for Bresnik's brother, Tommy, that night and had just taken brownies out of the oven at around 8:30 when Peter, Michael, Robert, and Thomas all came into the house. None of them had any dirt or smears or rips or anything on their clothing. She did overhear them sitting in the kitchen talking about a mini bike that they stole, but nothing about anything else. They had just stayed and they watched some TV together until about 11:30 that night. So now, and this is just my opinion, I think it was a weak case on the prosecution side, but also a weak case put on by the defense. So as a result, the two brothers, Michael and Peter Quatario, were originally charged as adults and sentenced to 9 years in 9 years to life, each of them in prison, which is the maximum for a youth at the time. They were 16 and 17 at the time of the trials. The jury had only deliberated for about 3 hours before finding them both guilty. Michael had always and continued to protest his innocence and said that he had been persecuted by the police and the DA, and that all of the witnesses had committed perjury, saying, "I was always brought up to trust the police, but I will never trust them again. I thank the police department and the district attorney for ruining my life," end quote. Both Thomas Ryan and Robert Bresnik was sentenced to 25 years. And so, of course, that was when the appeals started for all of them. So in 1989, Peter Criterio's conviction was actually overturned when these confessions were deemed inadmissible and they had been illegally obtained. And so he was released, and they never bothered to try to retry him. So he was basically acquitted, but at that time he had already served about 9 years by then. Michael, as far as I could find out, he actually served out his sentence, and that sentence was never overturned. He was paroled on a work release program in 1994. Now, part of the issue he had with getting parole in the first place was that he steadfastly maintained his innocence and therefore didn't show any remorse for his crime. Robert Bresnik's conviction was also overturned, but rather than be retried, he actually pled guilty to manslaughter, and then he was released in 1993, having served about 12 years, and apparently now lives in Virginia somewhere. Thomas Ryan had a bit of a go-round. So his original conviction was overturned, but he was retried and again convicted. And then he appealed again, and it was overturned again, and then he was retried again, and by that time it ended in a mistrial. But of course, by that time he had already served 18 years in prison. So in 2003, he pled guilty to manslaughter and was sentenced to 15 years, of which he had already served, of course, and he was released. Now, he is apparently now married, working in construction. He was 42 when he was officially released. In his statement to the court, he admitted to driving the three of his friends around to find Johnny P.S. So that was the horrible murder of Johnny P.S. Do I think that they got the right guys? I don't know. I don't get the feeling that Peter's confession was coerced. It just seems more like he kind of admitted it to kind of get it over with. He didn't have a lawyer, so he had waived his rights to that. It's weird that they didn't find any physical evidence like bloody clothing or shoes, but I don't know that Johnny bled all that much. I think it was more of like a swarm beating. And of course, when he started to yell, they shoved rocks in his mouth, not realizing that they would, of course, get lodged and cut off his air and kill him. I think they then panicked and then tried to cover it up. So I guess they served their time for being stupid, but John Pierce was furious. He felt that they had intentionally murdered him. I don't blame them for feeling that way. Even in today's world of DNA and forensics, there really isn't always that smoking gun that convicts someone with such a high probability. People get convicted on circumstantial evidence all the time. In a lot of cases, even where the evidence is pretty good that they did it, in other times it's pretty weak. I guess the lesson is don't be around or where a murder occurs and then no one can put you at the scene. Anyways, I'm not sure if John Sr. is still alive. I couldn't find an obituary for him, but Barbara, his mom, passed away in March of 2016 at the age of 70. So now before we go, let's talk a little bit then about this John Burke, since he's the whole reason I kind of researched this case. His story, again, doesn't really have anything to do with this case, but it's interesting nonetheless. And since he and Johnny P.S. were mentioned in this Gone Girls documentary, we might as well kind of discuss him and his career. So James was 14 at the time of Johnny's murder, so he was just a kid, but apparently doing a bit of drug dealing and some break-and-enters on the side for like pocket money. He joined the police force when he was 21. It was alleged that he had joined so that he could learn how to get away with crimes, but that's kind of speculation. By 1993, he had made supervisor, but got into a little bit of trouble when he was caught having a sexual relationship with a convicted sex worker and drug dealer. But he was considered a very good street cop because he had kind of a way with the locals, you could say. He did, however, lose his gun once, one night, while he was out with this sex worker known as Loretta. They had sex in his parole car, and sometimes he would like sort of shake down drug dealers for crack to use with Loretta, allegedly, that is. But this did not stop him from becoming chief of police in 2012. After all, Suffolk County back in the day was famous for corruption in the police force and in politics, which kind of often go hand in hand. They had a 97% confession rate, for Pete's sakes. You can't tell me they were all legitimate. But that is when he came on the radar of Thomas Spada, who was the head DA at the time, who was also the prosecutor on the Johnny Pius case, and remembered him. So now they were both rumored to be dirty. Spada sort of toggled back and forth between prosecutor and civil attorney handling victim lawsuits for cases that he had prosecuted. But we're not going to get into him in this episode. James Burke was described by a friend and coworker as horny and liked to chase women, particularly sex workers. He was often the loudest guy in the room and was a sex addict, in his opinion. On the night of December 14th, 2012, the police arrested a guy named Christopher Loeb. They roughed him up in the process, and his mom, Jane, came out, and so then they stopped at that point and then put him in the police cruiser and took him downtown. They then chained him to the floor and kept him in this dark room with no lights on and denied him access to a lawyer. Now, Christopher had been arrested because he had stolen a black duffel bag out of a 2008 GMC Yukon, which turns out to have belonged to James Burke, the now chief of police. In this bag were some things like handcuffs, mace, and a gun, but also a really nice stash of some pornography. And reportedly, James had reveled in the abuse that Christopher was getting and threatened to hotshot him with heroin so that he would never talk and it would look like an overdose. Christopher then called him either like a pervert or even went so far as to call him a pedophile, and that sent him into a rage, and he actually gouged Christopher's face with his thumbs. He then threatened the cops that they had better not say anything about what they had done to Christopher. But the FBI wound up looking into it anyways, and he pled guilty to federal charges of violating Christopher Loeb's civil rights and knowingly conspiring to conceal evidence of it. So he was actually forced into retirement, but he still received a payout from the Suffolk police of $434,370 in unused sick and vacation time. Then in 2016, he was accused of engaging in sex with another sex worker back in 2011, and that he had used drugs with her at that time. Now, he was actually convicted of the concealing evidence thing and served time for about a year between 2017 and 2018, of course, in isolation, being a former cop with friends in the DA. He was then put on house arrest and then finished his sentence in April of 2019. But in August of 2023, he was arrested at the Suffolk County Vietnam Veterans Memorial Park in Farmingville, New York, for public lewdness, offering a sex act, and unlawful solicitation. He pled guilty in September of 2023. Like, he just sounds great. Anyways, that is all I have for today. I hope that you enjoyed and that you will join me again next week for another deep dive into a horrible murder. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour.
Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder that you can skip the ads by signing up on Patreon to A Million Other Choices. If you or someone you love has been a victim of violent crime, please use your online directory to access victim services available in all provinces, territories, and states. You can find specialized services for children, Aboriginal people, and survivors of domestic violence. Some provinces have injury compensation or financial assistance programs. If you are in immediate danger, call 911, or if you are thinking of suicide, please call or text 988.